Call the House Judiciary Committee to order Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011. I have a public hearing, possible work session on House Bill 3166F.
Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 3166 bars filing a request for review of a land use decision or limited land use decision with the Land Use Board of Appeals 10 years after the date of the decision.
Okay, Representative Freeman.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker, and great committee of judiciary. For the record, my name is Tim Freeman. I'm a state representative from House District 2, and I'm bringing you a little bill today that could be deemed as a technical fix, but it may be a little more than that. I want to take just a minute and explain to you why I'm bringing the bill, and then just a minute to explain to you what the bill does. So, the folks that are with me, sitting behind me in the room today, Mr. Philip Bowles and his wife, Cynthia Bowles. Philip is a former lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. Philip spent 33 years protecting our country, only to come home to find that after 16 years of scrimping to pay for their land, that they're now having to defend their right to build a home on the property. Their defense has already cost them tens of thousands of dollars. And, of course, we all know people on military retirement plans just don't have the ability to pay such costs to protect their lands. No one, regardless of their military or not, should be put through such pain and agony by the few selfish people that don't want others to have the right to build once they get their homes, get their own homes built. The Bowles bought their property 16 years ago after the county fully approved of the dwelling of record. They paid the fees every single year for the extensions they needed to preserve the right to build. When they got out of the service, then when they came home, they found that due to very minor technicality in the rule, that they've had to spend tens of thousands of dollars to defend their right to build. Simply put, what occurred was this land use decision was made. All this time went by. When they came to actually build their home, because of a notification requirement 16 years ago, the county didn't do right, didn't do correctly, it allowed for an appeal. So the not-in-my-backyard homeowners around this area filed an appeal after 16 years. As you might imagine, it's awful hard to go back and find out who did what and why. So that's where the cost of having to defend this comes from. So that's the reason I brought the bill. Now, having that reason to look at this, I believe the bill that I brought you is just simply good public policy. So currently the state has a 10-year statute of ultimate repose for almost all kinds of civil lawsuits. This means that a civil lawsuit is barred from being brought to the courts if it is brought more than 10 years after the event given rise to the lawsuit. Unfortunately, that statute of ultimate repose does not apply to land use approvals. And I want you to think about that for just a minute. So after 10 years, you might think a land use decision or approval would be final, but it's not. So the end result is that a property owner who receives a land use approval may find that the approval being challenged decades after it was approved. So years and decades after an approval, you have to go back and redefend why the decision was even made. I don't believe that that is good public policy to allow someone to challenge a land use approval issued more than 10 years after it being approved. At some point, the decision needs to be final. That's all this bill does. It allows for that point after 10 years. 10 years is it. The land use decision is final. With that, I will answer any questions. I know the folks that asked me to bring this bill happen to be here. They're not signed up to testify. It is really that simple of a bill. Thank you.
Any members? Representative Schaaf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, thank you. I don't know how many stories we got to hear in this body about people not being able to use their land even after they went through this cumbersome, obstructive, prohibitive process that is designed to deny people their ability to use their own land in appropriate and appropriate manner. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. And to be clear, this doesn't change that process as you described.
I understand.
It merely says after 10 years that process is over and you can feel comfortable with the decision.
Thank you. Any further comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Dave Honeycutt and Ed Sullivan come up, please.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 3166. As Representative Freeman testified, this bill makes a minor but important procedural change to the LUBA appeal statutes, a change that we think is long overdue and will affect few cases, but the cases that it affects will be improved as a result. It draws a better balance between the legitimate rights of folks to file appeals in land use decisions and the rights of the property owner and the applicant to be certain at some point in time that the approval that they receive from the local government is final and can no longer be challenged. To my right is Ed Sullivan. I am entering my 19th year of practicing land use law in this state, and typically when I appear in this building, I'm one of the oldest, longest practicing land use lawyers. Ed is in his 41st year of practicing land use law in this state, has been doing this a lot longer than I have. Ed and I have argued and opposed each other at LUBA, at the Oregon Court of Appeals and local government hearings. We've debated at planning seminars around in various parts of this state and even out of this state. But he is one of the preeminent land use lawyers in this state, and I think adds some good testimony. He certainly qualifies as an expert if you have any questions about the technical details of the bill. So with the co-chair's permission, I'd be happy to turn it over to Mr. Sullivan to talk a little bit about the bill and answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, and sir, feel free to answer this question too. Why 10 years? Decision's been made. Why give someone 10 years to come in and cause trouble about people that are appropriately using their property? It's unbelievable. I would narrow it down to one. I think that's generous. But you can respond to that if you like. Thank you.
I'll try to do that during the course of my testimony.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Ed Sullivan. I'm an attorney who practices in municipal, administrative, and land use law. And I represent Mr. and Mrs. Bowes, who have, as you've heard, a 15-plus-year-old permit to them on which they relied in purchasing their land for a single-family dwelling. The permit was challenged last year by neighbors who said that the county should have held a hearing 15-plus years ago but didn't do it. There are other issues in the case, and I won't bore you to death with those, but taking an appeal 15 years after the permit is issued creates a number of fairly practical problems for the stability of land use permits in Oregon. Present law expressly states that the usual 21-day period time limitation does not apply when a hearing was required to be held but was not, but also expressly contains a further provision that the 21-day period for beginning a LUBA case does not run from when someone knew or should have known about the permit, when no notice is required. Instead, if notice is required, present law can be interpreted to say that a LUBA appeal can be brought at any time, even 15 or more years later. Now, there's something to be said for having a longer statute of limitations to bring a LUBA appeal if notice is required but not given. However, let me compare some of the timelines that exist in the land use area. First, the normal period is 21 days after the decision is made. There's a special extension allowed for those folks who are entitled to notice of the final decision but did not get notice. That deadline is 21 days from when they knew or should have known, but there's a maximum of 3 years for that. There's a 3-year statute of limitations in any event when a hearing is held for the petitioner to file a notice of intent to appeal. So even if that person was entitled to notice and did not get it, the permit is beyond appeal in 3 years. However, current law does not expressly cover those situations when notice of a hearing should have been given but was not. Under one view, one can bring a case after the structure is even built. Latches or waiver, which we lawyers know when you sleep on your rights, does not apply in this area. There are other time limits in current law for torts, either 1 or 2 years, for contracts, 6 years, or for possession of property, 10 years, but not for the situation in which property is purchased and the owner relies on the local proceeding. To us, that seems wrong. We've suggested a 10-year statute of limitations and suggest that that limit apply to all cases, either now before LUBA or to future cases. Our concern is that in 10 years, memories fade, records are lost, and the opportunity for mischief or blackmail abounds. For those reasons, we ask you to pass this bill out of the committee favorably. Thank you.
President Tomei.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Sullivan.
Yes.
So you don't need give me the particulars of this case, but help me understand. So the neighbors, they were supposed to have been given a notice.
Yes.
And that didn't happen. Is that correct?
That is what is alleged. This case is very complex. If you take the neighbor's view of it, they were entitled to notice.
Okay. And if they'd been given a notice, or as I recall in your testimony,
right.
if they should have known, what is it, entitled
right.
to a notice, but did not get that notice. And then the deadline is 21 days from when the petitioner knew or should have known of the decision.
With a maximum of up to 3 years.
Okay.
So if you found out a year later, and you bring the case within 21 days from when you found out, you're still within time.
Okay. If I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. So I'm just trying to figure this
sure.
out, not from this particular case,
sure.
but how this might apply other
sure.
places. So this person alleges they should have been given notice. So
yes.
theoretically, the county or somebody dropped
That's correct.
The ball and did not give them the notice. So... So you can't say that they should have known, because there was no way
That's
they could
correct,
have known. Is
because
that correct?
The knew or should have known doesn't apply in this situation.
Okay.
When notice was required but not given, statute currently says the limitations applied earlier in the same statute do not apply. It doesn't say what does apply.
Okay.
So the issue is, shouldn't there be something there other than saying nothing applies?
Last question, Mr. Chair, if I may. So why do you make it 10 years? I guess, Representative...
Because that's the longest statute that I thought would have the least amount of opposition.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you both.
Committee members, anything further? What if they had been approved and they hadn't objected right away and actual construction was started and then they found out they hadn't been noticed?
Under the current law, they could still bring the case.
So they could have a completed building living in it, and you weren't.
That's what I said about latches.
Yeah. Co-Chair Krieger, they could 15 years later, with a structure built of families living in it, the house being sold 3 or 4 times, they could bring the case.
And with the big Walmart, same thing.
Okay. We're trying to just to put an end to it at some
point. Offer.
Thank you. Yeah, there should be an end to it at some point. Thank you. But so what about the notifying agency? What responsibility do they play in this? I mean, they're just...
The county's position is that they didn't have to give notice. And that's the thing that lawyers can argue about.
So, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You sure may.
So then the landowner is just stuck in the middle of this legal argument, which is absurd. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It's just absurd. And it's a problem here in the great, beautiful state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffer, there are many things in this building that are absurd. Every day. And you don't have to look very hard to find them.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. Just one last point I think needs to be made, which is that when you are a landowner, whether you're on vacation property 3 states away or in your neighborhood like I am, one of the things that you're charged with under the law is paying attention to what's going on around you. You know, you are asked to be responsible enough to know what's going on and to know your rights, such as the ones that arise under land use. And if you sit back, in almost any other area of the law, if you sit back for 15 years, it's just too bad, except here. So that's why this is really a necessary bill.
Anything further? Mr. Honeycutt, I think Representative Schaffer's suggestion that you reduce that time frame probably has some interest. You might check with some of the Democrats and Republicans on the committee to see if we can get kind of a consensus of what that number might be.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. No one else was signed up on the bill, so we'll close the session.
Public hearing.
And we are going to have only a hearing on House Bill 3259 because part of it's not ready. Open a public hearing on 3259.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 3259 requires the Department of Transportation to release driver's license photographs to licensed private investigators. There is an amendment pending, and a combination of the rough draft of those amendments is available to the members at the dais, but it's not the final amendment. That is a combination that has been through Legislative Council's publications process. So it's an FYI set of amendments that isn't for distribution. The pending amendment that combines what you have before you permits rather than requires the Department of Transportation to release driver's license photographs to licensed private investigators. It also allows the department to adopt rules to establish requirements and procedure, the protocols that would control release of the photographs. It also provides for civil and criminal penalties for misuse of the driver's license photograph and allows an individual to obtain their own driver's license photograph.
Okay, we have Patrick Higgins, Ronald Miller, and James Gibson. Come up, please. State your names and when you testify, and everyone wants to start first, we can do so.
Okay, my name's Patrick Higgins, and I'm out of Clackamas County, co-chair, Barker and Krieger, and the rest of the committee here. I thank you for taking time to let speak on this bill proposal.
My name is Ron Miller. I'm from Vancouver, Washington. Thank you, co-chairs and the committee, for hearing us and supporting this bill.
You can just ID. You're going to go first.
Did you want all three of us to identify ourselves?
No, just as you...
Let Mr. Higgins go first. I don't know the protocol.
Okay. Real briefly, you should have handouts in front of you. It gives you a little bit of my background. I'm a licensed private investigator in the state of Oregon. Licensing started in 1998. That's when I first received my license. I'm also a contract compliance investigator for the state of Oregon. I'm a Vietnam veteran, prior as deputy sheriff, corporate director of loss prevention. Goes on into some more detail of my prior activities. I've been an active board member of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators since 1998. I'm the prior past president of that association. I've been board active with licensing for investigators. It started with the Oregon Board of Investigators, and now it's with the Department of Safety Standards and Training. And I'm also on a number of their committees. Our concern is about the DMV photos. Licensed investigators currently, a number of them have accounts with DMV as their statutes require regulations that allow us access to all DMV information. The only thing that we don't get is DMV photos. And that's what I'm here to speak about today. By passing this bill, looking at it, if it would enhance public safety, it would help also for investigator safety, and it would be a cost savings to a number of different clients of mine, anywhere from the attorney general to the state, to different municipalities, to corporations, attorneys, and private citizens. By passing this bill, it would, in my opinion, would definitely be a win-win situation for all persons and parties involved. because of the cost savings to the state on all their different cases that they have to contract out on, that enhances our overall need for investigation or our process. Most of the things that we do as investigators are regarding to some type of litigation, either litigation process or litigation is currently ongoing. Some of the examples for use of the DMV photos are locating and interviewing correct witnesses, victims, gang members, stalkers, street personnel, drug addicts, drunks, dealers, basically anybody, including domestic violence cases, endangerment of children, and workplace violence. So as you go on the my second page, I've already gone through part of the issues that would be resolved, investigative public safety, immediate identification witnesses, surveillance issues. Postal surveillance is what we term now is the terminology for workplace violence. If an employer has terminated somebody, a lot of times it's in the news media, a person looks for retribution against the employer. Threat assessments, surveillance is also included in this, is stalking and retribution. And on my examples, I'll give you a few of the stalking cases and also postal cases. Of course, there's always the criminal investigations, such as a lot of times everybody knows law enforcement is stretched on their budget, and victims tend to contact private investigators to see if we can resolve the cases for them. And burglary cases, different things like that. Everybody here probably understands that law enforcement does not have the manpower. Like when I was a deputy sheriff in 74, we went out on everything. We processed everything. Now they just don't have the money or manpower to do it. Child endangerment to drug abuse, loss prevention or internal theft. So that's just to mention a few. Attached to my statement also is four of the representatives. They're all licensed investigators. Dennis Byer from Baker City, Oregon. Robert Brown is licensed PI out of Coos Bay, Oregon. Vern Hoyer is licensed PI out of Brownsville, Oregon. And Ralph Radmer is licensed investigator from Clackamas. All these gentlemen wanted to be here today to do a presentation on behalf of this. Most of them are all prior to law enforcement. But for one reason, medical or scheduling, they just couldn't make it. So if when the committee has time, if you can read farther into the statement, read what they had to say. They gave just some slight examples of the situation. Also attached to my deal is the Driver Privacy Protection Act that we can go through, and that'll be after all the statements. On page 3, we start with the first example, burglary in Eastern Oregon, and the cities and jurisdictions have been eliminated just in case, you know, for privacy issues. Some of these cases could actually be found. There's two females that were victimized in two different residents. The investigation stalled out there in Eastern Oregon. Eventually came to the Valley where I was engaged, and myself and a couple other investigators worked the case. $145,000 in jewelry is taken between the two homes, not to mention some crystal collections, some firearms, and some other items. The case was eventually resolved. We were able to identify the person that did take the property out of both houses and persons that were driving the vehicle. It would save the client time and money once we started developing some names and also for identifying property, such as even in pawn shops down in Lincoln City area where we recovered some of the stolen property down there from pawn shops and also a private residence if we could have had photos. So the cost savings to the victims would have been substantial. I worked a break-in and entering in a rural town of the metro area where also people it was determined possible involvement besides inside to outside investigation of personnel that might have lived in that area. Once again, if we could add DMV photos, we might have been able to identify and get people to come forward and say this was the person they saw that day. Of course, we didn't have any photos. The case was resolved, but the outside parties involved were never prosecuted. Breaking and entering in the metro area, some people came into town to visit relatives. They were just here a couple days. The door was kicked in. Briefcase, laptop, credit card, some other things were taken. The briefcase in itself had proprietary documents of a high value for over $150,000. Of course, the investigation is a breaking and entering stalled within the police department because they just didn't have the manpower to keep up with. It took 4 months to resolve who stole it. We eventually resolved the person used the credit card. We resolved the burglar. We only recovered just a little bit of the property. If we had had DMV photos, the time of the investigation might have been cut in half, which would have been a huge savings to the victim. As it was, the briefcase itself was ended up in a landfill, and we weren't able to recover that because it just buried. Threat assessment and postal surveillance is the next one on four. In this case, a large corporation terminated services, and threats of blowing up a facility in the metro area came to light. Once again, no photos were able to obtain of the person. We coordinated also with the FBI. There was approximately 5 investigators engaged during the day and 3 at night to watch this person. The FBI was involved. In the end, eventually it was determined after about 2 months of ongoing surveillance, this was the person, but probably was just venting. There was definitely firearms, but it did take a while to identify this person because of the fact that the closest we could get to the residence was approximately a block and a half from there. Threat assessment on stalker in the for a city in the metro area. This case where city workers and city management official were threatened, and I was brought in and engaged a team of investigators, and we went out. The chief for that city advised that it would be simple just to do a door knock. We approached on that. Once again, photos were not available of these people. It turned out the first person I approached at the residence trying to do the door knock to find out about this individual ended up having multiple felony convictions of assault. As it turned out, during the course of the investigation, we eventually did get some photos. I'm not sure where, but DMV photos weren't released to us in this case. I believe they came out of Alaska, but eventually there was a permanent stalking order in place on this guy. There's a warrant out for his arrest. To this date, he has still not been apprehended. I have an ongoing assignment with that municipality because of fear of what this person's wanted to do to the city personnel. So during special events, we're called up and we set up a surveillance team to watch for him. We have postal surveillance, workplace. Just go ahead and skip 6. Personal injury, liability. This was also when the city's in the metro area. They were being challenged on a permanent disability from a person who was involved in an accident with the city. The only thing that could be afforded us was the address, and of course we ran DMV, received a license plate of the vehicle this person drove. We were told he was the only one in the apartment. We set up a surveillance team. Once again, it was a difficult surveillance area. We identify a male that used the car, lived in the apartment, and after a second go-around of surveillance, we identify a second male that lived in the apartment and was also using the car. And once again, no DMV photos were available to identify the person. After a number of days of surveillance, the city reviewed the photos and assumed it was the first one that we had identified. And as it turned out, because there was doubt, we talked to the municipality into going ahead and letting us add additional investigator for a longer-term surveillance. As it turned out, it was actually the second person driving the car that was our actual person, our subject of interest. And that turned out well for the city on the settlement. The last one.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Higgins, so you are a private investigator, right?
That's correct.
So what you're talking with us now is about law violations, and you're following up on those. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, but you don't just do that, right? You also, you're a private investigator, so I could hire you.
That's correct. All these the list that I read, all these people, I've worked for all these different people.
Okay, so I might hire you to find my ex-husband who owes, this is not true, but my ex-husband owes me child support or whatever. So could you also get his photograph from DMV?
Well, currently we
under this law?
Under the federal statute, we're allowed it. Currently, we're denied it. So the proposal is to change the law to get to bring in to what the federal guidelines give the licensed investigators. But in your case scenario, if you were looking for your ex-husband, the first thing I would say, I'd have to have a reason to institute engage in an investigation, a legal matter.
If I just want to clarify, but as a private investigator, you could use, if we pass this legislation, you could use this legislation to get his picture from DMV.
Only if there was a legal permissible purpose for the investigation.
Follow-up?
Litigation.
And who makes that decision if there's a legal purpose for that?
Actually, your investigator that you contact should, because we have statutes and guidelines. We're governed by DPSST in background. We're the only people other than law enforcement, fire, that are background completely, FBI background, criminal background. And because we cannot engage without a legal right to engage. And also, there's regulations under the Federal Act and the ORSs that we have to stay within. It has to be a legitimate purpose for litigation, a purpose for litigation in a case that we're working on. So if, as a private citizen, you call us, you want this, you just can't have it.
Okay, thank you. That's what I needed. Thank you.
Before you gentlemen continue, we have your written testimony, so please don't read it. Try to summarize. We've got a numerous number
right.
of bills, and we won't even get to anybody else that wants to testify. So I'm going to give each about another 3 minutes, and that's it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So the last one is a threat assessment that was contacted by an attorney in the metro area. He wanted to see if I could assist two court interpreters. And in this case, the proposed stalker that they thought they identified through a law enforcement agency, but once again, photos can be achieved to help in the investigation. The female left the state due to threat of the stalker. The male interpreter was actually assaulted twice in his garage because he could not identify who hit him in the back of the head. Nothing could be proceeded on. In the end, he left the state because he felt he couldn't afford an investigation. If you want to look back into the DPA regulations, that's on page 14, if you go through there, I won't go through it. As you go back, I've underlined statutes, or part of the statute, but federal guidelines that clearly state that licensed private investigators, through the course of our investigation for any type of litigations, are authorized to have the photos. They'd also told you basically newspapers and everybody else. Okay? Thank you for your time.
Yes, good afternoon. Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and the rest of the committee, thank you for hearing us. I'll try and keep mine short in lieu of time. I won't go through my entire testimony that's written, but I think it's important that you understand a little bit about who we are as investigators. Probably 20 to 30% of our investigators are retired law enforcement in the state. I myself am retired. I'm also a retired clinical mental health person. I specialize in those kind of areas. One of the issues that has come up...
You need to identify yourself. You see your name.
I'm sorry. Ronald Miller.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I did it the first time. I'm licensed in both Washington and Oregon, and I reside in Vancouver, but a good majority of my work is in Oregon. And so the situations that occur to me, that I won't go over those because we have 1,000 stories that we could give you. One that hasn't been talked about is the personal safety of investigators. I myself have been threatened by litigants in cases whom I had no clue as to who they looked like. And they claimed to know where I lived and where my family lived and where my kids went to school. And it was a serious felony case, and I would have loved to have had a photograph of that person, but I did not. But private investigators in Oregon are regulated by DPSST. There's extensive background, has already been testified to. They have to have experience, and they have to pass an exam. They have to maintain bond and insurance. They are subject to disciplinary rules from DPSST. The Department of Transportation does provide, under the ORs, that we do have access to all the DMV data except photographs, and they keep very good track of whose license is current and who isn't. They, DMV and DOT do a good job at that. So this change would just give us a little bit more piece of information that in this day and age when identity theft is increasing by leaps and bounds, people change names all the time. We don't know who they are. And we go to their residence, and unlike law enforcement, we don't have those resources to pull photographs. And if it's a civil case, it costs the litigants a lot of money to finally find these people or identify them. If it's a criminal case, then it's a court-appointed situation. Then it costs the state and the taxpayers money for our time. So that's one of the main reasons. I mean, that a number of reasons. Again, the federal statute is pretty clear. It's not written real well, but it does allow access to that information. I'm going to stop at this point and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. So you mentioned a civil case. I thought from Mr. Higgins said it was only in criminal cases that you get this information.
The federal statute states any case in which there is anticipated litigation. It doesn't specify civil or criminal.
That's a lot broader, isn't it?
So, you know, in civil litigation, and usually there's photographs available, but the DMV photographs, mind you, are the last resort photographs that we go after. Sometimes we can get booking photos, but that varies from agency to agency. And many times these folks have never been arrested. So it fills a gap.
Mr. Gibson. Hi, my name is James Gibson. I'm from Clatskanie, Oregon. Co-chair Barker and Krieger. Representatives, thank you for allowing us. I just wanted to let you know that we support passage of this bill. A little about myself, I'm a retired law enforcement. I worked for our local sheriff's office up there for 27 years, was a volunteer for 3 years before that. Actually had a lot of firsthand working with our computerized systems, which included back then LEDS terminals, which were dedicated terminals connected directly to Salem. Did a lot of the working with the agreements with LEDS. And we transitioned from those things into the new modern age, all the internet-based equipment that a company called Tailored Solutions here in Salem actually put together some software called ForceCom. And they actually, a few years later, developed the ability to download the DMV photos directly to the terminals that most all of the agencies now use internet-based. And so it's almost instantaneous for the law enforcement agencies. I had to retire about 3 years ago because of budget cuts, and natural transition was to get my private investigator's license and keep working. Been with this business now for a little over 3 years. I'm currently the president of our state association, was formerly the membership director. Part of my responsibilities there, of course, involves doing checks of any investigator that applies for membership in the association to make sure that they are indeed licensed and of good ethical and professional standards. One of the things that we talked a little bit about was the passage of this and the federal regulations. Passage of this would actually bring Oregon more in line with the Federal Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which is 18 U.S.C. 2721. I've attached a copy of that with my papers from Cornell University Law School, so I trust that it's accurate. That basically does allow for licensed private investigators to have access to the privileged driver's information. also been involved in situations out there where you go to a place and you knock on a door, you don't know for sure who or what's going to greet you. And unfortunately, having been in law enforcement so long, there's a lot of people out there that know me that I haven't a clue who they are. And, you know, this one situation, I've put it in writing for you so you can read it. I'm not going to go through it all. But it just shows that there is a danger out there. The people us licensed private investigators deal with are the same people that law enforcement deal with on a regular basis. Our risks and dangers are exactly the same as law enforcement folks. The only problem is we're private citizens. We don't have any authority whatsoever other than to run and try to get away from the dangerous situation. There's seven or eight other states that actually already permit the access to the DMV photos for licensed private investigators, and they all base it on what the federal statute allows. And so all we're asking is that Oregon adopt what's already provided for in the federal statutes. One of the things I looked into was the administrative rules, having dealt with the state police and the LEDS division. Actually, I re-reviewed that just this morning, and at first I thought it would require a modification of an administrative rule. However, after rereading that this morning, I don't believe that to be the case. There's already a section in the administrative rule that allows for the Department of Motor Vehicles to give authorization to them for the release of driver's information. I think all that would be required is DMV authorizing the LEDS division to okay for your local law enforcement or sheriff's office that already has that access to provide that to licensed private investigators. And it's easy to check. Your licensed DPSST maintains a database online, plus we're required under the statute to always carry that license on us anytime we're working. The one thing that it would do in the positive is possibly provide a revenue stream for some of the local law enforcement agencies that are actually hurting for finances and making cuts. They could charge us a reasonable fee for providing that photograph. So it actually has some positives to it, not just hard work. I don't think it would take a lot to put this measure into practice in the real world. I think it would be very quick and easy. With that, I'd like to again thank you for allowing us to come and present our information. Most of my stuff's written out for you. I didn't provide the administrative rule, but it's easy to access online through the state. So,
any members have further questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Have Larry Beckwith, Larry Fossum, come up. All right, DMV.
You're dealing with two Larrys here, so bear with us.
Go ahead, Larry.
I'm Larry Beckwith. I live in Beaver Creek, Oregon. I'm a retired law enforcement officer and licensed private investigator. I said the wrong thing to the wrong person about a year ago and ended up elected to the board of directors of the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators. I'm not going to read my statement, although I read much better than I ad lib. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'd like to reiterate some of the things that previous people have said in that Dog the Bounty Hunter and cheaters are not licensed in Oregon, nor are they members of our association. We are working hard to provide educational opportunities and a forum where people can converse about issues relevant to our business. And I'm wouldn't be a member of the association if I didn't think they were doing a pretty good job of that. I retired from the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office several years ago. I was a member of the Major Crimes Unit of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. During that time, I had access to LEDs, NCIC, FORCE, CLASS, PPDS, all kinds of sources of information about people, which included photographs from DMV. And I was amazed when I became a private investigator how few sources of information were available to me at that point. Most of my business is within the criminal defense portion of investigation. And I find myself dealing with the same people that I dealt with when I was a police officer. Only now I don't have the authority. I don't have the technology that I had then to provide for my own safety. As a police officer, I was involved in shooting situations. I'm very much hoping that's behind me. This is a personal safety issue where we're concerned. A lot of times we go out to try to meet with an individual. We have no idea what this person looks like, and a lot of times we end up asking for someone and they're telling us that the person isn't there when that person is actually the one we're looking for. And some of our I've walked into Hispanic gang houses. I once walked into a Red Cobra safe house without knowing I was there looking for somebody that I knew only as a witness in a case. I thank you for your consideration of this proposal. It affects somewhere in the neighborhood of only 700 licensed investigators in the state. I can't imagine that the cost of providing this to us is very great. We're willing to offset that cost by paying fees, and I would appreciate your support of this proposal. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to wait until you've all testified committee before we ask questions. So go
ahead. Okay. My name is Larry Rawson. I'm a private investigator. I own a business in Southwest Portland called Fingerprinting Services and Investigations. We do fingerprinting for the private sector if they're going to be doing a criminal background check on them. I support passage of this bill, and I want to thank the co-chairs for allowing us to come down. And rather than me read much of what and reinforcing what our association presidents and members said earlier, this is a very important bill for us because it is, as Larry said, it is a safety issue for us. We had a case where I was involved with Pat, where we had a gentleman, we didn't know what he looked like. It took people having to go out and try to get photographs. It may have jeopardized the case if we'd have been seen. However, we could have just went on and typed a code into the computer, paid our bill for the photograph, got this photograph. We could have passed it all out to all the investigators at the scene. We'd have known firsthand what this guy looked like. A lot of people say, well, you can go on Facebook now and get people. Well, you don't know whether it's Cousin Bill that's in the picture or if it's the guy that you're looking for. But we do know that license pictures are probably taken and accurately of the person and who he is. So that's an affirmation of what we really need here. And the cost, Pat wanted me to tell the committee, there are three other states, Arizona, Iowa, and Missouri, that also allow licensed private investigators to access the computer or to get driver's license photos. So this isn't new. It's something that's being done in other parts of the country. And I think that once the committee takes a look at this, and maybe even talks to the Department of Transportation. I can't see that this is going to cost the state a lot of money, and like Larry said, we're willing to pay money for those pictures if we need them. And I was a police officer in Portland. I was there 26 years. I went to work for the U.S. Marshal Service as a CSO. So I, like Larry and the rest of us, have all had those experiences on the street where this is just a very small reach for something that we already have here in the state of Oregon. And so if we could just fill that one loophole, allow us to get in there and get that picture, I think it's a safety issue for our client, it's a money issue for our clients, and it's a safety issue for us. And that's all really I have to say at this point. I want to thank again the committee for allowing us to come in and support of this bill.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan. I'm the DMV administrator with the Oregon Department of Transportation. As you know, the bill deals with the release of photographs to private investigators. There are restrictions in federal law, and those have to be looked at pretty closely. We have some policy, public policy issues with the bill, and we are working closely with committee staff on some redrafts, some amendments to the bill. So, the Federal Driver Privacy Protection Act was passed in 1994. It's been around quite a long time. And it restricts sensitive personal information that's contained in state motor vehicle records. Provides for civil and criminal penalties for improper disclosure of the information by the entities that receive it, as well as civil penalties for state motor vehicle agencies that are not in compliance with the law. So there's both sides of the releaser and the releasor. There are penalties involved. Private investigators are allowed to obtain personal information, which is defined as name, address, driver license number, and telephone number. There are exceptions that are listed. In federal law, there was an amendment in 2000 that reclassifies items, photographs, social security numbers, and medical type information. Those are considered highly restricted personal information. The federal law, and I think you know how a copy of it in the previous testimony, has some exceptions granted in that. Let me just read those to you. The first is used by a government agency or an agent, including any court or law enforcement agency, in carrying out its functions. Use in connection with any civil, criminal, administrative, or arbitral proceeding in any federal, state, or local court or agency. Use by any insurer or agent in connection with claims or fraud investigation, rating, or underwriting, and use by an employer or agent to obtain information related to a holder of a commercial driver license. Those are the four exceptions that are granted. Private investigators are not specifically exempted or included in that list. Now, there may be some ways you could get to the allowable by looking at that language in the federal law, but that is a concern that we have, that we be in compliance with the federal law in whatever is passed here in Oregon. Oregon's record privacy law took effect in 1997. It does go beyond the minimums which are in the DPPA. In some ways, we're proud of that, that we have some tighter restrictions in Oregon on release of information. We have tight restrictions on the release of items such as photographs. And for many years before the federal law went into effect, we have had those restrictions in place. Today, photographs are only available to law enforcement and to department employees in the course of our business. It's a very bright line that we draw as far as releasing photographs. In addition, the legislature has codified its policy statement recognizing the importance of protecting the personal information of what's contained on a driver's license to mitigate against identity theft. The bill, as envisioned in the amendments, would grant rulemaking authority to our agency. So DMV would have some authority to come up with ways that this would be possible without violating state or federal law. Also, several existing confidentiality programs could be impacted by the bill, and I'll just bring your attention to a couple of those. We do issue special driver's licenses to certain law enforcement individuals undercover. Releasing those photographs could jeopardize their safety. We would need some kind of protections around whether those photos would be released and how you would carve that out without inadvertently releasing their identity by saying we don't have a photo. So there's concerns around that.
Victims of domestic violence, we also provide special protections for those individuals. Releasing those photos or writing a rule with a particular carve-out again for those victims could actually place them at risk by indicating that we don't have a photo when we have a photo for everybody else. So just drawing that attention, that's an area of concern for us to look into. More generally, current Oregon law strives to protect individuals from fraud and identity theft. These crimes are on the rise, and protecting our photographs from inappropriate release isn't even more relevant today than it was even 20 years ago. We have concerns about the liability to the state. Existing law protects DMV and the state from liability if the release of personal information, the address, the driver's license, etc., leads to any damages. We have protections there. However, the bill, as initiated, does not have those types of protections in place. In addition, it's likely that if this bill passes, it'll just be the first of many requests in the coming years. There could be other groups that make this type of request. There's a bit of a slippery slope question or issue related to this. Not that this group is not going to take very good care of those photos. It's just it opens up a door that we do not have here in Oregon today. I'll also note that we have the State Highway Fund issues, the development and ongoing costs for providing photographs to private investigators is not an allowable expense with the State Highway Fund. There's a constitutional restriction on that. We're estimating in the $19,000 to $20,000 range as far as the costs of programming to ensure that only this group gets access to those photos and the billing and everything that's required for that process. So in conclusion, the bill, we do not think and believe that it protects the state of Oregon against those federal concerns that we've raised. As you work through amendments to the bill, perhaps we can address those and we can put rulemaking authority in place that would help us with that discretion that's required. We have concerns about privacy always, and we take that responsibility that you've vested with us very, very seriously. So thank you.
Committee members, questions?
Just briefly, I appreciate the work done keeping those records very secure, and this group can get everything but the photograph, and they are licensed. I mean, I think, I've looked at this before, in the subject a little bit before today, and I think it would be beneficial if we could allow licensed professional investigators in Oregon to have the ability to get those licenses at no cost to the state, and they've made pretty clear that they'd be willing to pay for the photos. And so if we are going to go forward with this, we'll also work in a piece to help pay for the whatever you would need to transition that over with a little bit more of a, like a surcharge on the pictures to help cover those costs so that the state doesn't have any costs. And also would want to be sure that we do have the liability protection of the state that you do now for the rest of the information if we move this out.
I agree. And we'll be working, Jeff, you and I will be working on staff, make sure it gets done. Representative Shaw.
I think you said, thank you, Mr. Chair. Iowa, Missouri, Arizona, they have major problems there. How long have they had it in place?
I'm not sure. I'd have to ask the people, do you know how long that Arizona's had that in place?
We know for at least 5 years.
I find out if they have problems there. I don't, but I'm just curious.
All right, we'll work it out.
Well, just one more thing. We'd be more than happy to work with you folks to make this agreeable to everybody, because it's as much our concern to protect people's identity as it is anybody's. Mm-hmm. So we'd be more than happy to put a committee together of people to work with you guys to come up with a good program to put this into effect. But I think it's doable, and I think the state has a chance to make a little bit extra money, and it allows us, again, as I said before, to do our cases at a safer level.
Okay, the staff then will put together a work group where the three of us can get together. We'll take care of it. Thank you for your testimony. No, nothing further, is there? Okay, thank you, guys. That's it. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3259. And House Bill 2547, we have an amendment coming, so we're not going to be able to work on that today. And also on House Bill 3151, we don't have the fiscal yet, so we'll have to hold that over at least until tomorrow. Yeah, we'll carry 2547 over tomorrow also. Okay, we'll have to carry over 2678 because the fiscal hasn't came in on that also. And 2683. Okay, we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2683.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 2683 was previously heard on March 1st. It permits the court to disclose confidential information about a protected person upon written request that complies with specific certification requirements and a showing of good cause in a protective proceeding. There is an amendment that deletes the specific certification requirements in the written request. It also allows inspection of information by an attorney considering representation of the protected person or by a person appointed or seeking appointment as a fiduciary. It clarifies the definition of a party as it applies to those kind of proceedings and declares an emergency and is effective on passage. It comes from the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral. And primarily, the persons who testified discussed the practical impact of the limitations to inspection and the limitations on the parties, and this would improve a more practical access from their perspective. We do. As I said, the Dash 1 Amendment deleted the specific certification requirements, and there's no fiscal and no revenue on the Dash 1.
Are they in yet?
They are not in the bill.
We don't want them.
I believe it was they were intended to be adopted.
Be adopted so that the fiscal goes away.
Is that what it is? There's a requirement of the request.
I believe it was the form of order. It had to do with the form of order. But the amendment deleting certification requirements, the way that the bill read as introduced would sort of dictate a form of order for the court to follow. The court can make certain findings in the best interest of the protected person without having the form of order dictated and specific findings being made in statute. So the purpose of the amendment was to sort of remove the likeness to a form of order, if that's... Representative Wan has a question.
Representative Wan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Actually, the way I'm reading line 33 through 45 on page 2 is that it requires that the party's attorneys make certain stipulations with regard to how the material will be protected and preserved from disclosure. Is that in another section of this bill so that it's not removed elsewhere?
Chairs and Representative Wand, I believe that's a different way to characterize the same thing that I'm saying. They can, when they move the court in their written request and the court issues its order, it is still free to say you cannot do A, B, and C with this information without the form being dictated to the court. The parties are still free to make those arguments and support their written request.
That's follow-up, Mr. Coacher. That's true, but if you remove this section, I mean, this section says that the court must order certain things with regard to confidentiality. We're taking out that section with the amendment, and so now presumably a judge could decide to say, I don't think this needs to be protected.
I'm going to have Bruce Miller come up for a moment, please, try to clarify
that. I don't understand. So, I'm not pursuing the point. I'm just curious.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Wan. My name's Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office of the Court's State Court Administrator. I didn't work on this bill, but I understand what's going on with the bill because the part the Representative Wan is talking about is actually going to be adopted into the Uniform Trial Court rules on August 1 of this year. And that's why the bar asked to have it taken out of the statute because it was already going to be taken care of by the rule.
Follow up, but the Uniform Trial Court rules are not statutory, and the Uniform Trial Court rules don't have the power in and of themselves to compel a judge to make a finding of non-disclosure or protection from non-disclosure. This statute would have done that. It says the written request for inspection filed under this subsection must contain certifications And then it goes on to say that the documents won't be reproduced, that they won't be given to other third parties, etc. The Uniform Trial Court rules is awesome for telling us what the form of these documents need to look like, but that's not the same as a statutory non-disclosure protection.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Wan, the proposed rule requires that the order be used, and it has the form of order in the rules, and it has the non-disclosure elements in the order.
One last thing, Mr. Co-chair. Thank you very much to the committee for letting me belabor this point. I think we need to make the policy decision here in this body whether we want these to be always subject to non-disclosure or not. And once we've made that decision, the UTCRs can do whatever they want to do with the form of order. But I'm here to tell you, the UTCRs are not always followed, and they don't have the force of law, and they don't have policymaking authority. We have that power by statute. So we need to make this decision. My belief is that we need to make this decision about whether these records should be subject to disclosure or not. If we want them to be protected, we should pass the bill as is. If we don't care either way, we should pass it with the amendment. But we shouldn't just punt this down the road to the UTCRs. Just my take on it.
Any further questions, committee? President
Shaw. No, I feel strongly both ways, Mr. Chair. I don't know. He's making a pretty compelling argument. I don't know what you guys want to do, but
if I could make a clarification, yes, or offer a further clarification, the Department of Human Services, when they are involved in protective proceedings, they are already required by statute to keep that information confidential, as is the court. The limits of the bill applies to who may access it and how, and the expansion is very small, as I read it, for what that's worth, rather than a fuzzy idea of who the parties may be, including only respondents and petitioners. The bill would allow, as I said, people seeking to represent protected persons or people who object, other purpose, third-party interests in the protective proceeding to look at the records and perhaps make copies of them, whereas without the bill, it's just a fuzzy definition of parties who are only allowed to inspect at the court in person and making notes, is my understanding. So the subject matter of the measure is more limited, although the form of order point well taken about putting the statute versus in.
Thank you. Now, if I may suggest, I think I have a solution that's going to make me sleep really well at night. Let's just add into subsection 5 here on line 30 somewhere, subject to the non-disclosure obligations under ORS, blah, 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 whatever it is. And that way, as a practitioner reading this section of the statute, you know, if they're unfamiliar with this area, they can avoid malpractice. They see that there's a non-disclosure someplace else, and then they can go look at that, and then we don't need the form of order language in there, but then everybody knows the first time they read this that these are confidential records.
I agree. That's the way it's going to be. Also, Representative Wisson has indicated he wants to carry this bill and explain it on the floor. Staff,
this is our first conceptual amendment.
With that conception, then we will discuss it with you and Mr. Taylor. So we're not going to work the bill on out. We'll bring it back in a day or two, carry it over, and we'll close the work session on 2683.
Mr. Chair, can we change some land use statutes like that today?
If we get the right relating clause, we might do it.
Amen,
brother. Okay. Open a work session on House Bill 2690.
Chairs, members of the committee, House Bill 2690 was heard on the 1st of March and also has a couple of amendments. There's no revenue impact. A fiscal statement has issued, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This measure allows the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to adopt rules governing electronic applications for court records and transmission of jury information to circuit courts and to establish reasonable fees for electronic access and services. It allows a master jury list for circuit court to include all the names on the source list or a percentage of randomly selected from source lists, allows the state court administrator to establish procedures for destruction of state court records, allows electronic filing of transcript on appeal, declares an emergency effective on passage. This comes from the Oregon Judicial Department, is anticipatory of e-court to enable more efficient electronic records and information management. The amendments make some technical adjustments to the provisions about appeals, and there was a little glitch, as I understood it, that prohibited transcriptionists from charging fees, but there is a fee that is permitted for the transcripts that are required by statute. So the dash two amendments incorporate the dash ones, so you'd only have to move the dash twos by themselves and make all the changes. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash twos into House Bill 2690. Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2690. Any discussion of the amendments? Okay, the amendments in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2690 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2690 as amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, only to say, I don't know how many years ago we were in David Brewer, Justice Brewer's work group talking about the transcription of electronic transcription of the record. And
that's right.
Here, I had no idea it was going to be on this committee when we finally got around to it, so thank you very much.
Call the roll.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Chocolate?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wong?
Aye.
Representative Woodman?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker?
Aye.
House Bill 2690, excuse me, is that right?
2693.
Yeah. Dash 2 has been referred to Ways and Means. Do you,
that's good. That's all we've got for
you. Okay, we'll adjourn the committee for today.
Who's that?